How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed.
Reference.
Hey ho, let's go.
Okay.
Punk edition.
I'm like, line.
Cultural reference, please.
Yes, please. I know nothing about anything of which we're going to discuss over the next hour and a bit.
How nothing?
I know what the Sex Pistols are.
Okay.
And I know that the man in this was in the Sex Pistols.
Mm-hmm.
And I can picture his face.
Yep.
And that's it.
I think you're going to surprise yourself.
Oh, I like when that happens.
I think you know more than you think you do.
Okay, okay. Well, let's find out. On the 12th of October 1978, Sid Vicious woke up in room 100 of the Chelsea Hotel. His bed was soaking wet. His first thought was that he must have pissed himself overnight, which wasn't exactly unbelievable. Vicious was no stranger to heavy nights. He had been a heroin addict ever since his mother gave him a baggie and two needles for his 16th birthday. He and his band, the Sex Pistols, were famous across the world for their raucous punk shows and lyrics that sent 1970s England into pearl-clutching frenzy. They were anarchists, anti-monarchy, anti-establishment, anti-everything. And Sid was the most provocative of all, the most notorious member of the world's most notorious band. A snarling, nihilistic, smack-addicted hellraiser. And when he paired up with loudmouth groupie Nancy Spungen, they became the ultimate, loved-up, dysfunctional, punk power couple.
But on that October morning in 1978, Sid Vicious hadn't wet the bed. He wasn't lying in piss, he was lying in a pool of Nancy Spungen's blood.
Much, much, much worse.
His girlfriend Nancy was lying slumped against the bathroom wall in her underwear. An 11-inch folding knife had been stabbed through her abdomen hard enough to come out the other side.
Jesus. Okay, can I tell you a story that I was going to say for Under the Duvet? And I'll bring pictures to Under the Duvet. Because it's to do with what you're talking about.
What, getting stabbed with an 11-inch folding knife? What have you been doing with yourself?
Living in London? No. Finding unexpected things in your bedsheets. okay, look, I bought some brand new bed sheets. I bought them and I was like, right, looked at them, folded them out, and I was like, yep, yeah, cool, here are the bed sheets. And then I was like, I'm going to wash them because they have like a weird smell to them. Washed them, took them out, put them out to dry. Next day, came and looked at them. Looks like there's blood on them. So it's just like patches of some sort of brown something all over these sheets. And I do not for the life of me know where they came from.
Mm.
Weird, right? Anyway, for the full story of Saruti's mystery sheets, come listen to Under the Duvet.
But for now, we have another arguably more interesting mystery for you.
Yes.
Who killed Nancy Spungen?
That is more interesting. In the grand scheme of things, I appreciate that.
Well, we probably won't be able to find out because everything, and I mean everything, about the night she died is up for debate. There are hundreds of overlapping, contradictory stories, and quite a lot of details have disappeared into the mists of punk rock legend. But today, we're going to try our very best to get to the bottom of it once and for all. Did Sid Vicious live up to his name and stab his girlfriend to death in a drug-addled fury? Was he carrying out his end of the couple's fuck-em-all suicide pact? Or was he innocent? So whacked out on dope that he slept through the whole brutal murder of the love of his life. With a hotel full of shady characters coming and going, thousands of dollars in cash nowhere to be found, and enough drugs to make a blue whale see God. This is one rock and roll story that you don't want to miss.
The man who would become Sid Vicious was born in Lewisham Hospital on May the 10th, 1957. And he was christened Simon John Ritchie. His mum, Anne Jeanette MacDonald, was just 25. And she'd already been married, got divorced, and joined the RAF.
She's packing it in. She's getting it done.
Classic 50s.
For now.
Yeah.
She very quickly stops doing things, I must add.
Yes. And it was when she joined the RAF that she met John George Ritchie, Simon's father. After the pair left the RAF, Ritchie guarded Buckingham Palace by day and played jazz trombone in smoky bars by night. Even early on in baby Simon's life, Daddy Ritchie would leave his new family for weeks on end. Eventually, Ritchie announced a grand plan to keep them all together. The three of them would go and start a new life in Ibiza. So off went Anne and two-year-old Simon to the Spanish island in the sun. But Ritchie, well, he never turned up. Simon's father never sent any money and was never seen again.
That left Anne stuck on a foreign island, single, jobless, and with a toddler to deal with. So she embraced her hippie leanings and started selling pre-rolled joints to tourists. And as he grew up, young Simon slash Sid was a hitmaker out the gate, constantly singing songs and impressing locals with the Spanish swear words that he learnt. Anne, his mum, said, apparently all of her friends predicted that he would either be nothing, a total dropout, or the Prime Minister of England. And where her son eventually sat on the scale of societal scourge had a lot to do with Anne's rock-bottom parenting.
It's already sounding quite Charles Manson-y.
Yeah, worse, I would argue.
Mm.
She never tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer, but she does do this. When it was time for them to return to the UK, Anne stuffed a brick of hash down her son Simon's trousers in an attempt to smuggle it through customs.
Fucking hell. The drug mule parenting.
Exactly.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And I think she got away with that one. But once she was back on England's green and pleasant lands, she really fucked up. She had heard a rumour that if you were a registered intravenous drug user, then you would be a shoo-in for a council house. So, one night she stayed up all night smoking weed and pricked her arm with needles to look like she had been injecting herself and then took herself to the council to apply next day. She looked so rough when she turned up that she wasn't even issued a drug test. They were like, here you go, have a council house. You're obviously in dire need. And it worked. Pretty soon, Anne and her son Simon, who would become Sid Vicious, were given a flat on Drury Lane.
On Drury Lane.
I would add, back then, rough as fuck.
Got it.
Horrendous. Like, not close to what it is now.
Sure.
Not even in the same universe.
Got it. But once they were in, the other shoe dropped. Those flats were known in the area to be held by the council for drug users. So soon enough, in a cruel twist of irony, harder drugs arrived at Anne's door. Weed became speed, which opened the door to heroin. By the time young Simon went to school, his mum was a full-blown smack addict and dealer to boot. Simon's main memory of his childhood was being pushed away so she could shoot up. He went to the Clissold Park School in Stoke Newington. There, he laughed off his unconventional upbringing with his friends. But there was always a rage burning behind his eyes. Furious at being forced to bring himself up, little Simon resigned himself to doing everything on his own terms. And that meant fucking off normal school, sharpish. So he enrolled himself at Hackney Technical College. There he showed some definite skill at art, painting watercolours and producing lifelike sketches. But much more importantly, this is where he met John Lydon. Soon to be known as Johnny Rotten, future frontman of the Sex Pistols and eventual butter peddler.
I really had a moment of silence for society when Johnny Rotten started doing butter adverts.
I remember.
I was just like, what have we become? Maybe that was the moment it all unraveled.
What have you become, Johnny Rotten?
But what have I become? Why am I what? Like, what have we all become? But
I don't know.
My favourite Johnny Rotten moment of all time is him calling the British public's cunts on I'm a Celebrity. Do you remember that? Live TV.
I do remember.
Mwah, beautiful. I do remember. When we were still the best at reality TV back then, in the golden era.
The golden age
of
terrible, terrible George Galloway meowing like a cat reality TV. So yes, teen Johnny Rotten had a hamster named after Syd Barrett from Pink Floyd. And one fateful day, that psychedelic hamster bit young Simon. And from that moment on, in our story today, Simon Ritchie became Syd Vicious. It's like a Spider-Man origin story.
It is exactly that. And I'm very glad we've got it out the way.
Thank God.
It's so difficult when people change their names and you have to like refer to them by their childhood name. And then I can't remember like what's left and right, or I can't remember my own name, my address.
I know. I'm writing a shorthand on Akhenaten right now.
I don't know what that word means.
Very different world we're in. He was a pharaoh who changed his name. That's a very niche reference for all the Egyptologists out there. He was Tutankhamun's dad.
Oh, very, was he?
Very overshadowed by his son. But, you know, fun story. I'll tell you about it on shorthand.
Thanks. Back home on Drury Lane, things had escalated in the drug department. Anne wasn't pushing Syd away from her anymore. Now mother and son were injecting each other. Her syringe full of heroin, his full of speed.
Yeah, it's very depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what Drury Lane was like. For Syd's 16th birthday, his mum gave him a bag of heroin and two needles. And soon after that, she kicked him out. She later told the press this. I remember saying to him, it's either you or me, and it's not going to be me. I've got to try and preserve myself, so you just fuck off.
I like that that's the bit she's saying out loud. So imagine what she really said.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's painting him as an evil influence, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Not something she created.
Sure.
So off Syd went alone into the wide world with his new name, his intense mummy issues, and a hunger for purpose. He lived in various squats, got into a lot of trouble. And there are stories from this time about him, like mugging people, selling fake drugs, dabbling in sex work, stuff like that. We can't confirm or deny any of them, but I buy it. But soon, he made his way to Chelsea. And rumour had it, that is where it was all happening. Just like Drury Lane is very different now, Chelsea was quite different back then. The punk scene was always, and is still, defined in opposition, and it was no different in SW1. By the early 70s, there was a feeling among some, quite a lot, of disaffected youth that rock music had lost its bite. There was the soft, radio-friendly rock of the Eagles, etc. Then there was the high-minded concept rock bands like Pink Floyd and Genesis. But for Sid Vicious and his newly found punks, all of the above were just a bunch of privately educated toffs making pretentious wanky art, which, like, arguably, true. None of it seemed to speak to what was happening around them. They didn't see themselves in any of it.
In the decades after the Second World War, the middle and lower classes in Britain were being squeezed, and wages were stagnating. And the political system didn't seem to be doing anything about it. The bright young things had no future. All they had ahead of them was work, obey, consume, and then die. So a group of anti-establishment misfits started expressing this anger. And the beating heart of this budding movement was on the King's Road in Chelsea, in a shop called Sex.
Capitals. Capital letters. Capital Sex.
Yes. Capital S, capital E, capital X.
Sex was a clothes shop owned by Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood. See, I told you, you know more than you think. Vivian obviously needs no introduction. Her boyfriend, however, I'll give it a crack. Malcolm McLaren was an upper middle class art school dropout with an eye for style and a definite grifter streak. Vivian Westwood was the architect of the entire punk look, all of which could be purchased in her shop on the King's Road. It's very clever, isn't it, marketing strategy to be like, I'm going to create the look of this subculture and sell it to you.
Absolutely.
Create the problem, sell the solution.
Look, I'm a big fan of Vivian, but yeah, absolutely. The idea that you're like selling back punk. I mean, yeah, you got to laugh. You got to laugh at the irony there.
As well as dog collars and whips and fetish wear, Sex sold counterculture t-shirts, ripped jeans and accessories as well.
I see. So they are the precursor to Tammy Girl, where we got our dog collars and ripped jeans and punky slogan t-shirts.
But it was more than just a place to pick up your punk uniform. Members of the scene would hang out at Sex for hours on end, days even. The shop was a roaring success. But it wasn't quite enough. Next, Malcolm McLaren wanted a band. He already had a guitarist and a drummer, two school dropouts with a healthy rap sheet of petty crimes and punk attitude coming out of their ears. They called themselves the Swankers. And after McLaren added bassist Glenn Matlock to the lineup, all he needed was a lead singer. And even if you've never heard God Save the Queen, you've probably guessed where this is going.
Sid Vicious was already a regular at Sex, mostly dealing from the back room. Knowing a star when she saw one, Vivian Westwood urged McLaren to take the storeroom speed slinger on as the front man. I had no idea that Vivian Westwood was the Simon Cowell of Sid Vicious. This is wild.
She kind of is. Malcolm McLaren's definitely the Louis Walsh.
Sure.
a bit more sort of like hitman hiring, a bit more schemey. But he's the on-site manager. Vivian's the ideas gal.
Sure. But this idea wasn't to be, because one day a guy walked into the shop with green hair and a t-shirt that said, I hate Pink Floyd. It was Sid's old college pal and hamster wrangler, Johnny Rotten. He was asked to audition for McLaren's band and chose to lip-sync to an Alice Cooper song as his opening number, jumping around like a wild man and pulling faces. To Malcolm McLaren, he was perfect.
That's a very famous image in like punk history of Johnny Rotten just going fucking mental.
Sure.
And the whole room being like, that's our Hitler.
So can he sing? Why is he lip syncing? He can't sing. Got it.
It's punk. You don't need to.
Sure. So the band was rechristened the Sex Pistols to promote the shop, and Westwood designed outfits that they wore on stage. Very smart. Again, not very punk, very smart.
Before the Sex Pistols even released a single, they told the press, we're not into music. We're into chaos.
Great.
It's great in so many ways, because it's Yeah, it's very anti-establishment. It's very fuck you. But it's also like, I don't have to be good at what I'm doing to make it happen. For it to be valid, I don't have to be talented at music in any way. Which, to be fair, nobody had done before. They spat, they snarled, they whipped up every crowd they played to into an anarchic whirlpool. And since the whole idea was to be as provocative as possible, the Sex Pistols got a reaction. They were often chased down after their shows, having to sprint to their van to avoid getting the shit kicked out of them. Still, for those that liked the band, the music, and the total chaos, it was life-changing stuff. And despite missing out on the band, Sid Vicious didn't have a Lawrence from School of Rock style mope about not being cool enough. People in bands are cool, I'm not cool. He just became the Sex Pistols' number one fan. Sid Vicious was a big dog on the punk scene, the real deal. If he thought you were cool, you really were. Inside Sex and beyond, Sid Vicious's approval meant everything.
Which again just doesn't feel very punk.
It's incredibly punk.
Is it? Because this idea of like you're looking for approval from somebody of...
One person.
Okay, okay.
The punkest of the punk.
Okay, fine. But you know what I mean. This idea of like it's meant to be like I don't give a shit what anyone thinks, but I get what you think, Sid.
Oh, no, I don't think I agree. I think like...
Everything's sceney. So obviously we're just humans, so we all look for that validation. As an ethos, I just think it's quite funny.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, but it's like nothing about punk is individualist.
Mm-hmm.
It's about community. It's about tearing down structure. It's about challenging the oppressor and like identifying with other members of the oppressed. So seeking approval from inside your community, kind of the archetype of your community, makes sense, I think. And he looked good. So everyone started to dress like Sid. And he was also great company. He was funny, he was charming, he was witty, and he was up for anything. And if you want to give that look a try, you will need a black studded leather jacket, ripped black jeans with a white cloth around your left thigh for extra points, black spiky hair, chains, razor blades, and safety pins hanging everywhere. That's your starter pack.
But what Sid really wanted was to be in a band. He was a punk purist, sure, but he also wanted to be famous with all the sex, drugs and rock and roll that it brought with it. Having been overlooked for frontman, he needed something else to offer. But he couldn't play an instrument, and two frontmen jumping around would just be ridiculous. So Sid scored some speed and stayed up for 3 days, listening to the Ramones' first album on repeat and only sleeping when he could play the bass part.
I fucking love that. Can't do it. Not sleep until I can. That's straight out of the Hannah Maguire book of how to learn things.
Hey, man, I respect that. You got to respect it. So after his self-imposed musical boot camp, he played with a band called the Flowers of Romance for a while. Then he switched to playing drums with Susie and the Banshees. And when we say playing drums, we really mean just bashing his drumsticks around indiscriminately and occasionally hitting the wall. Sid's MO on stage was to be as obnoxious as he possibly could. He was more adored than ever. And soon enough, there was an opening in the Sex Pistols. Yeah, it seemed to be a lot more vibes-based than specific musical talent.
It's an excellent business model. While Sid Vicious had been banging away at the bass and the drums elsewhere, the Sex Pistols' controversy courting was making them huge stars. In buttoned-up 70s Britain, Rotten's anarchic lyrics were headline news. They won a $40,000 contract with EMI in 1976, which is just about £900,000 in today's money. But when he called a presenter a dirty fucking rotter live on the BBC, that deal was swiftly cancelled. As were all of their future gigs. But outrage was their stock in trade, and it only fueled the fire. So they doubled down. They also sacked their bassist, Glenn Matlock, who'd been there from the beginning, for not being punk enough. Johnny Rotten actually called him a choir boy. And for his replacement, Johnny Rotten wheeled in his old mate, Sid Vicious. And I have to, we've been joking. We've been laughing. But this is very serious business. Sid Vicious, terrible bassist. Terrible, terrible, inexcusable, unrescuable, inadmissible, awful. But showman.
Straight vibes.
Straight vibes. Look the part. Everyone loves him. He's the king of punk. Of course.
Sure.
King of punk or choir boy, what are you going to pick?
Mm-hmm.
Actual musical talent or vibe? There's a great book on this case, which is called No One is Innocent, written by Alan Parker. And in it, Malcolm McLaren writes, "To watch Sid was to watch a raw, open, wounded creature being loved for doing something different. He was his own audience and star. If Johnny Rotten is the voice of punk, then Vicious is the attitude." And it was in these wild, freewheeling years, at the top of his game, that Sid Vicious met Nancy Spungen.
How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
This time of year, as I'm running from recording to meeting to catching up with my friends, I am so thankful for my wardrobe staples. Those things I can reach for over and over without having to constantly think about what I'm going to wear. Those items that elevate pretty much every outfit. And those that work for me on those days when the weather just won't make up its mind. And honestly, that's why I love Quince. Quince is all about elevated essentials that feel effortless. Everything is designed to mix, layer, and last, so that you're building a timeless wardrobe instead of chasing trends. I'm definitely eyeing up one of their 100% organic cotton sweaters. Everything is built to hold up season after season. The stitching, the fit, the fabrics. These pieces are ones you'll reach for over and over. And the quality honestly speaks for itself. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman, so you're not paying ridiculous brand markups. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/redhanded to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
So, press pause on our London story for now. And let's start again. This time in the well-to-do Philadelphia suburbs, in February 1958. Nancy Spungen had a wildly different start to Sid. Her family was comfortable, stable, respected in the community. But that's not to say it was an easy ride. Nancy was an incredibly difficult child from the very beginning. She'd have endless screaming tantrums and lash out in violent fits, making life a living hell for her siblings and parents. At their wits' end, the Spungens took young Nancy to a doctor who prescribed her phenobarbital. That's right, they gave phenobarbital to a toddler. Today, phenobarbital is sold under the brand named Luminol and is an extremely strong barbiturate and anti-epileptic.
Also, one of my favourite drag queens is called phenobarbital.
Oh, that's a good name.
Shout out, Phena.
Now, when this prescription didn't calm the chaos, successive doctors prescribed more and more drugs.
To no effect. Nancy was kicked out of her public school age 11 and packed off to Devereux, a school in Philadelphia for students with extreme emotional and behavioural issues. While she was clearly smart, with an IQ of 160, Nancy didn't exactly excel academically or socially. A former classmate called her, and this is a quote, "the most hateful person I have ever met."
Wow, that's so specific.
Which in a school for children with emotional and behavioural issues to the extreme,
yeah,
is quite something.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy's school years were packed with trauma and tragedy. A schizophrenia diagnosis, at least one suicide attempt, a self-inflicted coat hanger abortion, and a whole load of LSD. But Devereaux couldn't keep her forever. At 17, she went to the University of Colorado. After a few months, she was kicked out for stealing, and there was only one place for a burnt-out, drug-addled teenager to go. New York City. Nancy moved to Chelsea, the other one, and took up stripping and sex work to earn cash. From the minute she got there, Nancy had one mission and one mission only. Shag as many rock stars as humanly possible.
Okay, equally depressing.
And she went on to become a sort of super groupie, hanging out with and bonking members of Aerosmith, the Ramones, and Queen. When she slept with Iggy Pop, she phoned her best friend immediately afterwards. She couldn't help crowing about the new glittery notch on her rock and roll bedpost. To be fair, if it was the 70s and I just shagged Iggy Pop, I would ring everybody I'd ever met.
This is what I mean. What she's doing, as depressing as it all sounds, she's doing the best of it.
Oh yeah, and people hate her for it.
And I had to Google image her because I didn't know what Nancy looked like. Do we think Courtney Love was inspired by the Nancy Spungen look?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But Nancy was the first one to look like Nancy.
Got it.
So many women, knowingly or not, have based themselves on Nancy Spungen. Mm-hmm.
So this approach, as Hannah mentioned, did piss a lot of people off. Groupies were nothing new, but the stick-thin, pretty young things that had fawned over rock stars since time immemorial looked down their noses at Nancy. She was a junkie and a stripper to boot. And to make matters worse, she wasn't the shy, adoring type. She was brash, loud, unashamed, and unapologetic. To paraphrase the Sex Pistols, Nancy knew what she wanted, and she knew how to get it. In its way, this was pure punk. And she also had another leg up on the other groupies. She always had drugs. Nancy was getting $200 a night stripping, on top of whipping bankers in a dominatrix house on the Upper East Side, which paid very well.
So she's not dependent on the rock stars to give her anything. She's got her own money. And the others hate her for it.
Mm-hmm. And she'd spend the lion's share of her cash on drugs for herself and whoever happened to be around. Still, despite her confidence, Nancy was clearly in trouble. By this point, she had a full-blown heroin addiction. She attempted suicide at least twice more during these first years in New York. And she'd go from life of the party to a screaming rage in a matter of seconds. Life was wearing her down. Nancy Spungen was tired. And a change is as good as a break.
So, she changed strategy. Her new goal was to go to England, get a rock star boyfriend, and bring him back to New York.
Okay. It's a plan.
She did. It worked. And so, in December 1976, Nancy flew to London and started hanging around in the other Chelsea, our Chelsea, on the King's Road. She knew how the scene worked. She'd done it all before. She bought the clothes, she hung around the people, she went to sex and the 100 Club. And just like Madonna, she adopted a weird pseudo-English accent pretty much straight away. It took about a year of graft, but soon enough, American import Nancy Spungen and the king of the UK punk scene, Sid Vicious, were an item. Sid and Nancy were perfect for each other. Furious at the world, dysfunctional, all attitude, no fucks to give. Plus, they shared one very important, all-consuming hobby: drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They look like a Halloween costume.
I'm sure they have been many times, yeah. They're both very, even though they have different upbringings, very, very tortured, but in very different ways, and they found the same solution.
Mm-hmm.
You can see just how constantly out of it they both were in every interview they ever did. It wasn't perfect, destructive, for sure, but they were quite clearly head over heels in love with each other. We've got an example of a handwritten note from the time which was titled "What Makes Nancy So Great" by Sydney. And Sid Vicious lists 12 of Nancy's best assets, from number one, beautiful, and number two, sexy, all the way down to number 12, a great hustler. Moving to London, however, didn't stop Nancy from being difficult. She was verbally abusive and physically aggressive. And to put it very mildly, the scene surrounding Sid did not take to his new squeeze. There was a real Yoko vibe to the conversation surrounding Nancy. We all know how that one goes. Great man, who would have been fine if it wasn't for this strange, meddling, whiny, unpredictable woman getting her claws in. And we can argue about Yoko Ono and her bowler hats full of perfume another day. But in this case, that attitude, that rhetoric of the meddling woman is kind of half true.
Another Courtney Love comparison also.
But did she shoot him? I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I really don't.
No.
Courtney, come on the show. I love you.
So Sid and Nancy definitely amplified the worst parts of each other's personalities. She was far from a grounding presence. But it's not like he was an angel before her. And Nancy also did a lot of campaigning on his behalf. Because all Sid's money went straight into his arm, McLaren limited his payment from Sex Pistols' royalties.
Which, like, arguably, not a terrible management move from punk Louis Walsh.
Yeah, yeah. Which meant that although Sid was one of the most famous people in the country, he was also broke. Nancy fought tooth and nail, angry that he wasn't getting his dues, convinced that she could manage him better than anyone else. She even talks for him in interviews. Even questions directed at Sid she would take. Off camera, friends were starting to get seriously worried. Sid told them that Nancy wanted him to kill himself, or that she wanted them to die together, to go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, absolutely worrying things are happening, and I think people around Sid had every right to be concerned about Nancy's influence over him, and I don't doubt she was a nightmare. But it's not like he was completely fine before she showed up. She made it worse, for sure. But I don't think that he would have been
A-OK.
A dream to work with had she never shown up.
And the leading member of the I Hate Nancy Club was definitely manager Malcolm McLaren. In Malcolm's eyes, she was the only thing standing between the Sex Pistols and world domination. All Nancy wanted was money, drugs, and Sid. And she had plenty of all three.
So why would she go anywhere?
McLaren was determined, however, to solve the Nancy problem. So he, McLaren, arranged for Nancy Spungen to be run over by a car. He even bought Nancy a one-way ticket to New York. And while Sid was at the dentist, Nancy was dragged out of her hotel and driven kicking and screaming to the airport. But nothing could keep the punks apart.
June 1977 was the Queen's Silver Jubilee. The nation was gripped with a royal fever. And the day before, the Sex Pistols released their most controversial song yet. God Save the Queen. A venomous, no-filter takedown of the royal family. We cannot explain to un-British people how taboo that was. We're talking 50 years ago. Being a flag-waving royalist was part of the national character. That's what being British was about. So lines like "God save the Queen, she ain't no human being," and references to a fascist regime that she ran, were really not cricket at all. This was serious business. The Sex Pistols were attacked with knives in the street by royalists. MPs literally called in the Commons for the band to be hanged at Traitor's Gate.
Oh my God. You're just adding to it.
Exactly. It's beautiful. It's just, mwah. Oh, I love it. Hoisted by your own petard. Fantastic stuff. And to top it all off, the Sex Pistols, God Save the Queen, was the highest selling single in the UK that week. And then they released their album. Never mind the bollocks. Here's the Sex Pistols. Came out on October 28th, 1977. It was a rebel yell, taking aim at every authority structure there was, and it went straight to number one. And if you've heard this album, which I hope that you have, and you think that the bass isn't that bad, well, that sausage is because Steve Jones, the guitarist, re-recorded all of Sid's bass parts.
Good. At the peak of their powers, Malcolm McLaren plotted his next big management move. And I'll be honest, it's a strange one. He planned a US tour. Not of the major cities where US punk was already making waves, but of bumfuck towns in the deep south. The Sex Pistols played a series of honky-tonk country bars to rednecks in cowboy hats. And as for why, there are two possible reasons. A, it was another attempt to whip up maximum hate and controversy. And B, to get Sid Vicious as far away from heroin and Nancy as possible.
I strongly suspect it is option B.
Yeah. Either way, none of it worked. Every show was a total war zone. Glasses and bottles would fly, and guitarist Steve Jones once smashed an audience member over the head with his actual guitar. And yes, Sid was separated from his two loves. But he was not a happy bunny. He was kept on methadone, putting him in a constant state of semi-withdrawal. And he was furious that they'd banned Nancy from coming on tour. He'd also show up late for all the shows, or not at all. And when he did turn up, he was fucked out of his mind.
I do think it's an interesting thing to like have built this whole thing on punk and counterculture and then expect everyone to turn up on time and sober. Like, come on.
Now, before the Dallas show on the 10th of January that year, Vicious carved the words, "Gimme a Fix," into his chest with a razor. In their efforts to court controversy, McLaren and the band had been encouraging Sid to be as damaged and reckless as possible. And now they were paying the price.
Yeah. Like, that's part of the deal.
Yeah. For the rest of the band, this was a warped cartoon of what they'd set out to do. The last US show was in San Francisco on the 14th of January 1978. When it was over, Johnny Rotten famously asked the crowd, "Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?" And they never played again. After just two breakneck years, the Sex Pistols were done. And Nancy had Sid all to herself.
Just for the well, actually, us. I know the Sex Pistols reunited in 1996 and they played, but it's not important. The Sex Pistols were done for, and London didn't want Sid and Nancy. So Sid got on the first flight to New York. On the way, he overdosed on diazepam, methadone and alcohol and went into a coma. In August 1978, Sid and Nancy checked into the Chelsea Hotel. And the names they gave to the guestbook were Mr. and Mrs. John Ritchie. The Chelsea Hotel has a legacy all of its own. It became known as a hub for literary figures, including Dylan Thomas, Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams. Throughout the 60s, it hosted the cream of the zeitgeisty crop, everyone from Andy Warhol to Bob Dylan. It is truly iconic. However, cheap rent and an incredibly permissive free bohemian attitude attracted a much rougher clientele as well. By the mid-70s, the first three floors of the Chelsea Hotel were filled with drug addicts, their dealers, and sex workers.
In other words, Sid and Nancy Paradise. With drug dealers just down the landing, they lived in a constant haze of weed, booze, pills, and as much smack as they could get their grubby little hands on. They fought constantly in front of their friends, trading venomous insults and savage physical blows. Nancy grew violently protective, and the more people tried to separate them, the more intense Nancy got. When Sid got back from Paris, where he had been filming a documentary, Nancy cut her wrist to protest being left alone. Bit by bit, the pair alienated themselves from the outside, developing a repetitive routine. Mostly their world was at the Chelsea Hotel. Nancy would go out stripping. Sid would go into friends' rooms, get high, and wait for Nancy to get home with more drugs. But it has to be said, Nancy wasn't a bad manager. She did get Sid a string of gigs, and even put together a backing band. His notoriety worked a charm, and tickets sold like hotcakes. Sid was quickly bringing in $4,000 a night.
In the 70s?
Yeah.
And it's not like their overheads are high.
No. But he was a mess on stage, barely able to finish a song. But the crowds were electric. and the money propped up their 2-gram-a-day heroin habit, which to Sid and Nancy was truly all that mattered.
One night, after a particularly large heroin binge, Sid passed out with a cigarette in his hand, and the mattress caught on fire. The fire spread quickly around the passed-out couple, and they were only saved because a neighbour called the fire department. And somehow, the legendary passivity of the Chelsea Hotel meant that they weren't kicked out. Instead, they were moved to room 100. So the first 3 floors are all junkies, artists. But, like, second, third, less intense. The first floor is the real hardcore people. And that's where they were moved to. It was solidly the drug addict floor. And that came with its own set of problems. Plus, people were attacking Sid nightly at his own shows. And both of those things did no one's paranoia any favours. Nancy bought her boyfriend Sid a Jaguar K11 knife for protection. And just over 24 hours after she bought it, that knife would be sunk into her own chest.
How do you like the sound of a bank that's built for you, not the 1%? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, you should check out Chime. Chime isn't just another banking app. They unlock smarter banking for everyday people with products like MyPay, giving you access to up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and getting paid up 2 days early with direct deposit. They also don't charge an overdraft or minimum balance fee, so you're in control of how you spend your money. In fact, there's no monthly fee at all. Instead of charging you to use your own money, Chime actually turns everyday spending into real rewards and progress. It's the new way to build credit history with your own money and get rewarded every single day. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings, which is 7 times higher than a traditional bank. Several of my mates have already switched to Chime for their everyday spending, and they say that they have never felt more in control of their money. Chime is not just smarter banking, it's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. It just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/redhanded. That's chime.com/redhanded.
This time of year, as I'm running from recording to meeting to catching up with my friends, I am so thankful for my wardrobe staples. Those things I can reach for over and over without having to constantly think about what I'm going to wear. Those items that elevate pretty much every outfit. And those that work for me on those days when the weather just won't make up its mind. And honestly, that's why I love Quince. Quince is all about elevated essentials that feel effortless. Everything is designed to mix, layer, and last, so that you're building a timeless wardrobe instead of chasing trends. I'm definitely eyeing up one of their 100% organic cotton sweaters. Everything is built to hold up season after season. The stitching, the fit, the fabrics. These pieces are ones you'll reach for over and over. And the quality honestly speaks for itself. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middleman, so you're not paying ridiculous brand markups. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/redhanded for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/redhanded to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/redhanded.
The 11th of October 1978 was the last night of Nancy Spungen's life. And like we said, the facts of that night are hazy. Every moment has been told in 100 different ways over the years. But we've done our digging. And here's what we're confident probably happened. At about 9:30 p.m, Sid and Nancy went for dinner at their friend's apartment. Those friends were Neon Leon Webster, an artist and drug dealer, and Kathy O'Rourke, his stripper girlfriend. That evening, Sid was morose, looking at old photos of himself, saying he'd lost his looks. That he had no future, whilst idly stroking his face with a giant fuck-off knife. Nancy was pacing around, saying that what they needed was drugs, good ones. She said her dealer, Rockets, would come over later. Kathy then had to go out to work, and Leon went out to a club called the Nursery. There's good evidence that Sid and Nancy then left the Chelsea Hotel for about an hour or so. When they got back, they stopped by a few friends' flats, asking around for heroin. They didn't find any. What they did have was Tuinol, a prescription sedative hypnotic.
Which, like Quaaludes, you can't get anymore. One of the Guildford Four was on Tuinol when he was arrested. It is so fucking hard. It's not even prescribed medically anymore.
Yeah, incredibly potent. It has two barbiturate salts, and according to the manufacturer, it's designed to provide a rapid yet prolonged hypnotic action. At about 10 p.m., back in room 100, Sid took 30 Tuinols. He stayed awake for another few hours.
Just fucking heroic. How?
But by 1 a.m., he was passed the fuck out. And this is where the story goes in a million different directions. So first, we'll give you the story that Sid told police initially, which is that he was so knocked out by the Tuinols that he slept through the night. Whatever had happened to Nancy, it hadn't woken him up. He was out cold until about 9:30 a.m. when he woke up in a pool of Nancy's blood.
The police arrived on the scene at about 10:45 in the morning. Room 100 was a bomb site. It stunk, there was rubbish everywhere, dirty clothes all over the place. And there were several mattresses lying around the room, one sporting a blood-stained handprint. In the bathroom, Nancy was lying in her black underwear, slumped between the sink and the toilet. She had a single knife wound just below her right breast, deep enough to come through the other side. On top of an open suitcase sat an 11-inch folding knife. It had been wiped clean. There was no blood, no fingerprints. Nancy's corpse was taken out of the Chelsea Hotel in a body bag. Sid came out in handcuffs. Inside the Chelsea, everyone was convinced that Sid had killed Nancy, it seems obvious. So were the NYPD. Sid was charged with second-degree murder. At the station, Sid changed his tune. He claimed that when he first discovered Nancy, she was breathing all right, but she wasn't bleeding, so that meant that she was unconscious when he found her, but not stabbed or dead. So he didn't call an ambulance. He went out to get her some methadone instead. And on this second telling, Nancy wasn't covered in blood until he returned. And his first move after discovering his girlfriend drenched in blood was to wash the massive knife and then try to wash Nancy. Sid told his interrogators that when he realised Nancy just wasn't going to stop bleeding, he called for help. And he also insisted that he absolutely did not stab her.
Then he changed his story again. In version 3, Sid said that he'd had a fight with the bellboy out in the hall. I love that the Chelsea Hotel has bellboys.
Hey, man.
When you're strung off your tits, you're not going to move your own shit, are you?
Absolutely not.
So yeah, he says he had a fight with a bellboy in the hall and then had a row with Nancy back in room 100. He said that she punched him in the nose right where the bellboy had hurt him. So he got out a knife to threaten her. Apparently she leaned forward and he stabbed her accidentally. According to Sid, neither of them thought it was that serious, so they both fell asleep. When Sid woke up, he went straight out to get his methadone. And when he came back, he discovered Nancy's corpse on the bathroom floor. Eventually, Sid told police, "I stabbed her, but I didn't mean to kill her. I loved her, but she treated me like shit." But then he took it back, saying that's not what he meant. After a mess of different stories, finally Sid conceded that he might have done it. He was just too fucked up to know. And yeah, after taking 30 sleeping pills plus God knows what else, he probably was.
Yeah, sleeping pill just isn't quite strong enough either. I'll come on to what I think. It didn't look good for Sid Vicious for obvious reasons, but let's point out some specifics just for the fun of it. He had told police that he came back to find Nancy dead in the bathroom, but all of her blood was on the mattress, which seems odd. How did Nancy crawl all the way to the bathroom after losing all of that blood on the mattress? Surely it makes much more sense that she was stabbed and then bled out on the bed. and then moved, presumably by Sid, to the bathroom to wash up the evidence. Pretty open and shut, it feels like. And for Sergeant Kilroy of the NYPD, the one who arrested Sid, it was the only explanation of events that mattered. As far as he was concerned, these two were dysfunctional junkies, and one of them was dead. End of story. As for why Sid stabbed Nancy, you can take your pick of theories. There's the suicide pact. Sid had told friends that they had talked about ending their lives together. Neon Leon, actually, told the Soho Weekly News that he believes Sid was planning on suicide that night. Because Sid had given him all of his prized possessions just the night before. His gold records, newspaper clippings, a beloved leather jacket. Felt like he was saying goodbye.
Or, like Sid's testimony, could it have been an accident? Or a fight that got out of hand? Easily done when you're totally out of your fucking tree and you've got a giant knife. Or was it some sort of sex game gone wrong? Sid and Nancy's sub-dom games were known to extend to knives. Could he have just gone too far before they both passed out, leaving Nancy to slowly bleed to death?
You will see people say that a lot. No. I feel like they were absolutely in a sub-dom relationship. In pictures of Sid, he's wearing a padlock on a chain like Youngblood used to. Like, that is a symbol of being in a sub-dom relationship. And I don't doubt that, like, they engaged in knife play. But the difference between knife play and stabbing her so hard it comes out the other side is not an accident. It just isn't. And I know we've spoken about this before, but I feel like the sex game gone wrong thing is thrown around so casually. And it just... No, that, like, there are many things I am unsure of in this case. I am sure it wasn't sex game gone wrong, because things literally never are.
No, I just don't buy it. And it's just one of those things that, as a society, we've, like, accepted. Yeah. I'm not saying everybody has, obviously, because a lot of people, like, screaming against it. But it's just the idea of, like, well, you know, why have you got a knife at? Well, it's just part of my sexual fetish. How dare you question that? And then if you can't question that, well, then, you know, sometimes things get dangerous and sometimes people get stabbed. Like, it's just an accident. But don't you dare question why we were doing it. It's just, it's so fucking weird. It's so fucking weird. Anyway, we're not buying into that sex game gone wrong. But there are plenty of things that could have happened that night between Sid and Nancy. But they were also far from the only people around that night. And Sid is far from the only possible culprit. Plenty of people saw and spoke to Sid and Nancy that evening. So here's a quick-ish timeline of what those people say they remember. At about 2 a.m., Nancy called a man named Rockets Redglare. His nickname comes from the fifth line of the American National Anthem, but his real name was actually Michael Morrow. Born to a 15-year-old heroin addict mother, Morrow's start wasn't exactly much better than Sid's. In fact, he became addicted to heroin while still in the womb. And after he was born, doctors gave him opiates in his baby formula to wean him off. He was also beaten by his drug-addicted stepfather, who later killed his mother. But that didn't stop Morrow becoming a comedian, and even starring in a film with Madonna.
Can't keep a good man down. I don't think he's a good man. I think he's... quite possibly responsible for Nancy's death, actually.
I mean, yes, bad people, lots of bad people doing bad things in this story. But what I will say, it's a tale that, if nothing else, tells you that no matter how shit and fucked up your start is, you can be anything you want. Even if you have no talent as well.
By 1978, Rockets Redglare was Sid and Nancy's personal bodyguard / drug procurer. And the night Nancy died, she rang Rockets just like she had told Neon Leon she would, saying that she had $1,400 to spend on drugs. But remember, no money was found in the hotel room.
In the 70s, how much fucking drugs can you buy for that amount of money? That's bonkers.
If you're Sid and Nancy, not enough.
Clearly.
What Nancy wanted that night was Delorded, another legal-ish drug, an opiate prescribed as a painkiller. And Rocket said that when he got to room 100, Sid was out cold. Nancy grabbed the money from a bag of new notes and they spilled out all over the floor, and he crucially says that nobody else was with them. So he goes out, goes to find the drugs, and then later he came back to room 100 with actor Ned Van Zandt. And he agrees with the story. He confers that that is what happened. According to Rockets, while him and Ned Van Zandt were there, Sid actually got up a couple of times to check on the door and briefly leave the room. Additionally, the hotel manager told NYPD that he saw both Sid and Nancy returning to the Chelsea Hotel at about 3:30 a.m. and that Sid was shouting at Nancy. Sid and Nancy's regular quaalude and two-and-old dealer Steve C told a reporter much later that Sid and Nancy came to his room at 4 a.m. All of these people live in the Chelsea Hotel.
Yeah.
It's kind of like student halls of horror.
Mm-hmm.
And very American Horror Story Hotel as well.
Oh, yeah.
Rocket's Red Glare also says that he saw Steve C in the building entering a lift just before 5 a.m.
I've got to say, we've covered a lot of cases in our time. And typically people are like, oh, I heard this thing or I saw this thing, but I have absolutely no idea what time it is or what time it was. I didn't look at the clock. But like, we are expected to believe in these stories.
Yeah.
That a bunch of people who are all
smacked
probably
off their tits,
yeah, just fucking out of their tree on all sorts of like, it was around 5 a.m.
Everyone's got a watch.
Everyone's just like having a little look, a little check, just in case I need to remember this for some reason later. That's just a little sprinkle of skepticism on my part that I'm going to throw out there.
You're allowed it.
Thank you.
An actor called Victor Colicchio says that Nancy called him around the same time, so 5 a.m., and that he went down to room 100 to see what she wanted. When he got there, Sid was passed out on the bed, but there was another man in there as well, who was not Rocket's Red Glare. He's very annoyingly fuzzy on more details. He can only remember the first letter of this man's name. He says it was something like Snake or Skippy or Stevie. But I'm inclined to believe him more than anyone else because he's like, oh, not sure.
Yeah.
Was quite fucked.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, not that much help, but it does raise the possibility that this mystery visitor who nobody can identify, Snake, Skippy or Stevie, killed Nancy and then fled. In the following weeks, Colicchio fled to the Bronx, terrified that this mystery S-man would come and find him.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't really describe a more high-risk lifestyle than what's going on here.
I don't think you could describe a more perfect environment to get away with murder.
Also true.
Malcolm McLaren.
Now, Kenneth West, the poor fucking long-suffering, no doubt, bellboy at the Chelsea Hotel.
There's a reason he's there. He's getting something out of it, I'm sure.
True, true. You don't have to be a pedo to want to work with kids, but it probably helps. I don't think everyone who works with kids is a pedo.
I do.
It's just a little joke.
I certainly do.
So, yes, Kenneth, the bellboy, testified under oath that he did indeed scrap with Sid that night, just as Sid had said. And this is what went down. At about 5 a.m., he responded to a complaint by a resident on the second floor. West went up there and found Sid being loud and aggressive. Then Sid launched at him. West was pretty trim and, surprisingly, sober. And Sid was a stick-thin heroin addict. It's like in the land of the blind, the man with one eye and all that. So it wasn't a particularly long fight, and Sid was left bleeding from the mouth and nose. And West said that he left the hotel at about 5:15. A Chelsea resident who stayed anonymous testified to police that Sid staggered into their room at 5:30. He was disorientated and his face was covered in blood. According to the autopsy, Nancy was stabbed between 6 a.m. and 7 a.m. and she died between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. And this random room invasion is the last reported sighting of Sid for the all-important next few hours.
So we know that the fight between Sid and Kenneth West happened. And it's pretty likely that Sid is wandering around for a bit after that, bleeding, hurt pride, office tits.
Sure.
At 7:30 a.m, the resident of room 102, so the one next door, heard a woman's voice coming from room 100. The woman inside room 100 was moaning, and she sounded like she was alone.
How does that?
I think those walls are real thin.
Sure.
But interestingly, room 102 didn't report shouting or fighting or any other disturbance. However, she does live on the first floor of the Chelsea Hotel. So I don't think we can...
Yeah, a room, you know, a hotel full of witnesses, all certified unreliable.
Yes. And the plot thickens yet again. At 9:30 a.m, the Chelsea's front desk got a call from an outside line saying that there was trouble in room 100.
Mm.
So the manager on the desk sent a bellhop upstairs to see what was going on. And after the bellhop left, the manager got another call from Sid Vicious saying that his girlfriend was hurt and needed an ambulance. Sid was also seen at 10:30 a.m. entering the hotel. Where he'd been wasn't clear. And then at 10:45, the police were there and they arrested Sid Vicious. His lip was split, his right eye was puffy and swollen from his bellhop beating. And his perp walk photos, he looks really, really rough. You've probably seen them. He looks exactly like the kind of lowlife who would have killed his junkie girlfriend with an 11-inch knife. But what if he didn't?
So yes, there are plenty of alternatives. And of course, many of the above accounts come from individuals and often fairly, as I said, unreliable witnesses. But if we take this timeline, what could have happened? Well, one theory goes that it was a hit. Sid was a star on the verge of being signed by Virgin. Anyone with an interest in his career wanted Nancy gone. Practically everyone in his life back home had been furiously watching her suck the life out of him for years, hitting him, screaming insults at him, keeping him on the smack. And while the list of Nancy haters is a long one, Michael McLaren's name is often thrown into the ring. He had tried to get rid of her before.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
Not non-violently.
Mm-hmm. And as for the hired killer, well, people came and went from the Chelsea all the time. It'd be very easy to slip out unnoticed.
And let's briefly revisit Victor Colicchio's mystery S-Man. There was a roadie slash drug dealer called Skip Wayne. And he fits the bill very nicely for this mystery intruder. He was known to have sold drugs to Nancy before he would have had no problem getting into the room. And it's easy to believe that a pissed off dealer could have lost his cool and stabbed her. Maybe she owed him money. Maybe he just wanted her cash. All of these are very reasonable assumptions. But the reality is there could have been any number of criminals coming in and out of room 100 within those lost 12 hours. When the police dusted for prints, they found six sets that weren't Sid's or Nancy's. But mostly, when talking about real alternative suspects to who killed Nancy, the name that comes up time and again is a memorable one, Rockets Redglare. Writer Phil Strongman, who wrote the book Pretty Vacant on this case, is convinced that it was Rockets that stabbed Nancy for her cash while Sid slept. And Ned Van Zandt told police that he saw Rockets Redglare with loads of money tied up with a purple hairband. And Rockets tried to kill Ned Van Zandt a few weeks after Sid was arrested.
And that's not all. On the day before Nancy was killed, Rockets Redglare was reportedly in a bar, begging drinkers to lend him a dollar for a beer. But the next day, he was seen in brand new clothes, spending money all over the East Village. One witness even saw him in a bar with a wad of blood-stained banknotes. And that's not all either. Rockets confessed to the murder. Not to the police, but over the next few decades, he would tell multiple people, in confidence, that he had killed Nancy Spungen for her cash. He even, just before he died, approached several people trying to sell what he called a snuff film of Nancy's death. Perhaps it was just a last-ditch attempt to cash in on his proximity to the infamous murder. But Rockets Redglare certainly had the means, motive, and opportunity.
Yeah, I think with any sort of, like, infamous murder like this, there are always going to be confessing Toms. And, like,
yeah.
I don't doubt that he could be just lying and trying to, like, make money off the fact that he knew her.
Yeah.
But I could also see it. I think he absolutely could have done it. I don't know I buy the bloodstained banknotes thing, but, like, I can see it either way.
Totally.
Anyway, for the police, it was Sid all the way. He was charged with second-degree murder, but the evidence was quite weak. There were no reliable witnesses and shady folk coming and going. Other suspects just couldn't be ruled out. So Sid was granted bail at $50,000. Malcolm McLaren hounded the bosses at Virgin Records to stump up the cash. And amazingly, they did. Before you're too impressed, though, lifelong grifter Malcolm McLaren didn't waste any time cashing in on the tragedy. Within days of the arrest, he'd already started selling T-shirts with Sid's face on them that read, "She's dead, I'm alive, I'm yours." Okay, did he? Fuck.
Fucking hell.
Sid also found himself being represented by hotshot lawyer F. Lee Bailey. That arrangement was secretly funded by none other than Rolling Stones frontman Mick Jagger.
Wow.
And that is star power.
Mm-hmm.
Talentless my ass.
So Sid was out after 3 days, and he was not well at all, as you can imagine. Despite his showbiz connections, he drifted around Manhattan, staying with friends. His mum, Anne, had flown in to take care of him, which we're putting in the world's largest air quotes because what she actually did was supply him with heroin. After this, Sid became more and more erratic and sunk into a deep depression. He told Nancy's mum they'd made Nancy a promise. If anything happened to her, he'd kill himself. And he seemed hell-bent on sticking to his word. A week after his arrest, Sid unscrewed the light bulb in his hotel room, smashed it, and slashed his wrists. When he was found, he screamed, "I want to go to Nancy now. I don't want to carry on." Later, he tried to jump out of a window. He then spent a month in Bellevue Hospital psychiatric ward.
Almost as soon as he got out of Bellevue, he was rearrested. He'd broken his probation and the investigation had thrown up some fresh evidence against him. So he was sent to Rikers Island. And actually, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to him. He was whacked on a methadone program, and this time for the first time, it worked. Sid Vicious was drug-free for weeks at a time. His mood shifted. He was calmer, more reflective. And even after he was released on bail, for a while he stayed clean. He went to shows, he hung out with friends, and said he was working on a new album. He even got himself a new girlfriend, a nice one, called Michelle Robinson. While Nancy had been depressed and angry and difficult, Michelle was a bit more stable. Oh, fine, it wasn't like completely fine. He did have a little slip-up in January 1978 when he smashed a bottle over the head of Patti Smith's brother. So, straight back to Rikers he went. But again, it was good for him. This time, he was totally clean for over a month. His legal team were getting ready for trial, and they felt like they had a pretty good shot of winning. According to his friends, Sid was jovial, happy, and contemplating a bright future. A future that would never come. All down to his dear old mum, Anne.
On the 1st of February, the day after Sid left Rikers Island after 55 days, his mates threw him a jailspringing party at Michelle's apartment. Members of the Misfits and the New York Dolls came over, as did his mum, Anne, who served up a spaghetti bolognese. And as a gift, Anne gave her son a wrap of heroin.
I think, and maybe this is just being autistic, but I think I could quite happily only eat spaghetti bolognese for the rest of my life. I think that's why I don't really care about restaurants that much.
That is very autistic.
Because I'm just like, oh, like, no, this is fine. We're having a nice time. But like, I'd actually rather just be eating spaghetti bolognese.
That's fair enough.
That I have to make. No one else.
Okay, okay.
Only I know how to do it.
Got it. Fuck it, man. Eat what you like. That's what I believe.
I can't just eat spaghetti bolognese for the rest of my life
no,
in the size of a house.
Don't eat spaghetti bolognese for the rest of your life. But I think it's okay to feel like you only want to eat spaghetti bolognese for the rest of your life.
Sometimes I'm like, how far could I push it?
What's your, like, max in a row eating spaghetti bolognese?
I've never allowed myself to try.
Oh. What do you think would happen? What do you think you could do?
Forever.
There is no limit.
Limit does not exist.
So yes, she makes up her spaghetti bolognese. She's like, here you go. Here's a wrap of heroin. Does heroin make you hungry?
No, it makes you constipated.
Oh, God. Heroin and a spaghetti bolognese. That sounds fucking horrible. Anyway, it's such a horrible thing that she gives him this, though, because Sid had been a month clean by this point. But of course, you know, it's a gift from mummy. So he took it and immediately shot up. And later, as you can imagine, demanded more and more. So his friend, a man named Codrick, left to get some. Why? Well, Anne said that if they didn't, then Sid would just have left to get it himself, which would violate his curfew.
I feel like Anne might have wanted some more heroin.
Yeah. Fucking, well. It's like that thing where it's like, well, if your child wanted heroin, would you give it to them?
Mm.
And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I would. He loves heroin.
Off a bridge.
He fucking loves heroin. I love heroin. Of course I would.
Supercut that so we can send it to all the people on the internet convinced of your addiction.
I can't believe I forgot that you guys thought I was addicted to heroin. That's just the best thing ever. Anyway, Codrick returned from this little heroin run just before midnight. And the stuff he'd picked up was unbelievably strong. 98% pure. Sid couldn't resist. And after 55 days cold turkey, his tolerance was down. So he immediately overdosed and started to turn blue.
To be clean for 55 days and your mum to just be like straight away.
That fucking bitch, man. Oh, yeah. Gross. So yeah, he's turning blue. His friends dragged him to his feet and shoved Percocet in his mouth and walked him round until he eventually came to. After this, Sid apologised to everyone and the party was over. Everyone, apart from his new girlfriend and mum, Anne, went home. But by the morning, Sid Vicious was dead. His naked body was found at 5:30 a.m., surrounded by a syringe, a spoon, and a bag of 98% pure heroin. He was 21 years old.
Fucking wild.
That's unbelievable.
It's a lot of life to have lived by 21.
Anne later told police that Sid must have got up in the night, found the stash, and shot up again. The coroner's report, however, made it very clear that Sid had been helped. His own mother gave him the shot of heroin that killed him.
Why? Like, obviously she's smacked out of her head, but why? Like, surely, in a purely cynical sense, he's your fucking cash cow.
I don't think she wanted him to die.
Yeah.
I think she possibly just miscalculated how long he had been clean for. And, yeah, it's an easy...
Yeah.
Easy mistake to make. We've all misprescribed heroin to our sons, you know?
And killed them by accident.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just all so depressing.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to go have a shower and a bowl of spaghetti bolognese.
In the end, Sid was cremated. Where he ended up depends on who you ask. His friends claim that they wanted to honour his wishes of being next to Nancy forever, but since her remains were in a closed Jewish cemetery that would never accept Sid Vicious, they had to improvise. So they drove down there themselves. And on the way, Howie Pyro, a bassist in various bands, suggested that they all snort Sid's ashes.
What?
I mean, they're not the first people to have that idea.
Did they do it?
He did.
Oh!
No one else joined in.
Oh my God.
So that just means that just the world's loudest awkward silence, I can imagine.
Fuck me.
And then when he realised that no one else was going to partake, they all jumped the cemetery fence and Sid and Nancy were reunited.
I'm going to say, a little life hack. Mm. If you're going to suggest something completely mental, don't be the first one to do it. Make someone else do it and then do it.
If you are the person who's going to be suggesting the thing that is mental, your impulse control might not be that strong.
Quite true. Sid's mother, Anne, tells another story about how it all went down. She told Johnny Rotten that she took Sid's ashes on a plane back to London. And true to form, she hid two bags of heroin in her son's fucking urn. This woman just will not stop. Apparently, when she got to Heathrow, she panicked and threw the whole thing down an air conditioning shaft.
Right. I've spent a lot of fucking time at Heathrow. Not once have I seen an open air conditioning shaft that I could hurl an urn down.
What is she on about? So yeah, it's one of those tales that we don't know if it's true. but we kind of hope it's the first one. At least it ended up with just bit of Sid getting snorted by his mate rather than getting shoved down a fucking air conditioning shaft at Heathrow.
Yeah.
So after her son's death, Anne moved to Derbyshire and carried on selling drugs and started playing in a punk band called Road Rage. And they'd end every show by playing Sid Vicious's version of My Way.
The only thing sicker than killing your own son with heroin is dining out on his legacy for the rest of your life.
She's gross. But she didn't kick around for too long, because one night Anne went home after a gig, shot up, and died at the age of 58.
Despite their short lives, Sid and Nancy's reputations are etched into the cultural landscape, consciousness, whatever you want to call it, forever, and they ain't going nowhere. And in a way, whichever version of the story you believe, it was inevitable that it would come to an end like this. Johnny Rotten later said what we're all thinking. Her death, as in Nancy's, is all entangled in mystery. It's no real mystery, though. If you're going to get yourself involved in drugs and narcotics in that way, accidents are going to happen. And I think he's right.
Yeah.
And I think Malcolm McLaren fucking knew that. Here's what I think happened, right?
Hit me.
I don't think Sid accidentally stabbed Nancy in any sort of way. I think that Rocket's Red Glare or someone else was put up by Malcolm McLaren to get rid of Nancy.
I can buy it. He saw her as the big stumbling block. Thing is, I can buy any of these things happening.
Totally.
Which is why it's obviously such a mystery.
And you can't argue that they didn't die as they lived.
No.
Doing exactly what they wanted whenever they wanted to do it.
Exactly.
Your mum killing you with heroin, though, is just,
It's very, very, very miserable. It really does feel like a... You know when we were in New Zealand and we did that little, like, who killed this person mystery pack?
Oh, God, yeah.
It feels like a story written for that.
It does, doesn't it?
Because there's just so many possible people that could have done it. So that's it, guys. Let us know who you think did it. I know that feels like such a terribly hacky little plug at the end, but I am curious. I've had a very interesting time recording this episode, though. I feel like I've learned a lot. Hopefully you guys have. Let us know what you think, and we will see you next week for another episode of Red Handed.
Go and listen to the Sex Pistols, please, if you haven't. Especially if you haven't, because otherwise they don't let you into Britain at customs. Bye.
Goodbye.
Menards' 11% rebate is here. From lighting to lumber, from doors to floors, the bigger the project, the bigger the rebate. From painting projects to that new kitchen makeover and designing that outdoor space of your dreams, save big on any project you're tackling. Hurry into Menards for an 11% rebate on everything. Mail-in rebate is a merchandise credit check, not a point-of-sale discount. Redeemable on future in-store purchases only. Not on future purchases on Menards.com. See store for details.
Save big money at
You may remember deep in your mind cave, we once told you about a podcast, wasn't once, it was last year, called Wisecrack, from our good old buddy old pals over at Tenderfoot. Wisecrack is a really unique blend of stand-up comedy set and a shocking true crime case. Basically, a comedian describes the night he found himself at the centre of a double murder. Wisecrack has gone on to make Apple's best podcasts list, and that's full of people like us, so you know it's true. And it's nominated for iHeart and Ambie Awards this year. And it was The Guardian's podcast of the year. Top tier, number one, top spot. And now Wisecrack is heading on a true crime / comedy tour with comedian Ed Hedges performing his stand-up set live. And it's in a city that is maybe, very possibly, near you. Wisecrack's tour will hit Dublin and Manchester as well as London on Valentine's Day. And then it will head into the US for February and March. For dates and ticket info, visit wisecracklive.com. That's wisecracklive.com, and search Wisecrack in your podcast app to listen to the show and see what all the noise and hype is about, my friend.